I went into the bathroom and took off the toilet paper roll and replaced it with a fresh one. Luckily, it was almost empty already. I unrolled the rest of the paper and dug through my parts box until I found a little plastic envelope full of ultra-bright white LEDs I'd scavenged out of a dead bike lamp. I punched their leads through the cardboard tube carefully, using a pin to make the holes, then got out some wire and connected them all in series with little metal clips. I twisted the wires into the leads for a 9-volt battery and connected the battery. Now I had a tube ringed with ultra-bright directional LEDs, and I could hold it up to my eye and look through it. I'd built one of these last year as a science fair project, and had been thrown out of the fair once I showed that there were hidden cameras in half the classrooms at Chavez High. Pinhead video cameras cost less than a good restaurant dinner these days, so they're showing up everywhere. Sneaky store clerks put them in changing rooms or tanning salons and get pervy with the hidden footage they get from their customers. Sometimes they just put it on the net. Knowing how to turn a toilet paper roll and $3 worth of parts into a camera detector is just good sense. This is the simplest way to catch a spy cam. They have tiny lenses, but they reflect light like the Dickens. It works best in a dim room. Stare through the tube and slowly scan all the walls and other places someone might have put a camera until you see the glint of a reflection. If the reflection stays still as you move around, that's a lens. There wasn't a camera in my room, not one I could detect anyway. There might have been audio bugs, of course, or better cameras, or nothing at all. Can you blame me for feeling paranoid? I loved that laptop. I called it the Salmagundi, which means anything made out of spare parts. Once you get to naming your laptop, you know that you're really having a deep relationship with it. Now, though, I felt like I didn't want to ever touch it again. I wanted to throw it out the window. Who knew what they'd done to it? Who knew how it had been tapped? I put it in a drawer with the lid shut and looked at the ceiling. It was late, and I should have been in bed. There was no way I was going to sleep now, though. I was tapped. Everyone might be tapped. The world had changed forever. "I'll find a way to get them," I said. It was a vow. I knew it when I heard it, though I'd never made a vow before. I couldn't sleep after that. And besides, I had an idea. Somewhere in my closet was a shrink-wrapped box containing one still-sealed, mint-in-package Xbox Universal. Every Xbox has been sold way below cost. Microsoft makes most of its money charging games companies money for the right to put out Xbox games. But the Universal was the first Xbox that Microsoft decided to give away entirely for free. Last Christmas season, there'd been poor losers on every corner dressed as warriors from the Halo series, handing out bags of these game machines as fast as they could. I guess it worked. Everyone says they sold a whole buttload of games. Naturally, there were countermeasures to make sure you only played games from companies that had bought licenses from Microsoft to make them. Hackers blow through those countermeasures. The Xbox was cracked by a kid from MIT who wrote a best-selling book about it, and then the 360 went down, and then the short-lived Xbox Portable, which we all call the Luggable, it weighed 3 pounds, succumbed. The Universal was supposed to be totally bulletproof. The high school kids who broke it were Brazilian Linux hackers who lived in a favela, a kind of squatter slum. Never underestimate the determination of a kid who is time-rich and cash-poor. Once the Brazilians published their crack, we all went nuts on it. Soon there were dozens of alternate operating systems for the Xbox Universal. My favorite was Paranoid Xbox, a flavor of Paranoid Linux. Paranoid Linux is an operating system that assumes that its operator is under assault from the government. It was intended for use by Chinese and Syrian dissidents, and it does everything it can to keep your communications and documents a secret. It even throws up a bunch of chaff communications that are supposed to disguise the fact that you're doing anything covert. So while you're receiving a political message one character at a time, Paranoid Linux is pretending to surf the web and fill in questionnaires and flirt in chat rooms. Meanwhile, one in every 500 characters you receive is your real message, a needle buried in a huge haystack. I'd burned a Paranoid Xbox DVD when they first appeared, but I'd never gotten around to unpacking the Xbox in my closet, finding a TV to hook it up to, and so on. My room is crowded enough as it is without letting Microsoft crashware eat up valuable workspace. Tonight, I'd make the sacrifice. It took about 20 minutes to get up and running. Not having a TV was the hardest part, but eventually I remembered that I had a little overhead LCD projector that had standard TV RCA connectors on the back. I connected it to the Xbox and shone it on the back of my door and got Paranoid Linux installed. Now I was up and running, and Paranoid Linux was looking for other Xbox Universals to talk to. Every Xbox Universal comes with built-in wireless for multiplayer gaming. You can connect to your neighbors on the wireless link and to the internet, if you have a wireless internet connection. I found three different sets of neighbors in range. Two of them had their Xbox Universals also connected to the internet. Paranoid Xbox loved that configuration. It could siphon off some of my neighbors' internet connections and use them to get online through the gaming network. The neighbors would never miss the packets. They were paying for flat-rate internet connections, and they weren't exactly doing a lot of surfing at 2 a.m. The best part of all of this is how it made me feel. In control. My technology was working for me, serving me, protecting me. It wasn't spying on me. This is why I loved technology. If you used it right, it could give you power and privacy. My brain was really going now, running like 60. There were lots of reasons to run Paranoid Xbox. The best one was that anyone could write games for it. Already there was a port of MAME, the multiple arcade machine emulator, so you could play practically any game that had ever been written, all the way back to Pong. Games for the Apple II, and games for the ColecoVision, games for the NES and the Dreamcast, and so on. Even better were all the cool multiplayer games being built specifically for Paranoid Xbox. Totally free hobbyist games that anyone could run. When you combined it all, you had a free console full of free games that could get you free internet access. And the best part, as far as I was concerned, was that Paranoid Xbox was paranoid. Every bit that went over the air was scrambled to within an inch of its life. You could wiretap it all you wanted, but you'd never figure out who was talking, what they were talking about, or who they were talking to. Anonymous web, email, and IM. Just what I needed. All I had to do now was convince everyone I knew to use it too. Chapter 6. Believe it or not, my parents made me go to school the next day. I'd only fallen into feverish sleep at 3 a.m, but at 7 the next day, my dad was standing at the foot of my bed, threatening to drag me out by the ankles. I managed to get up, something had died in my mouth after painting my eyelids shut, and into the shower. I let my mom force a piece of toast and a banana into me, wishing fervently that my parents would let me drink coffee at home. I could sneak one on the way to school, but watching them sip down their black gold while I was drag-assing around the house, getting dressed and putting my books in my bag, it was awful. I've walked to school 1,000 times, but today it was different. I went up and over the hills to get down into the mission, and everywhere there were trucks. I saw new sensors and traffic cameras installed at many of the stop signs. Someone had a lot of surveillance gear lying around, waiting to be installed at the first opportunity. The attack on the Bay Bridge had been just what they needed. It all made the city seem more subdued, like being inside an elevator, embarrassed by the close scrutiny of your neighbors and the ubiquitous cameras. The Turkish coffee shop on 24th Street fixed me up good with a go cup of Turkish coffee. Basically, Turkish coffee is mud, pretending to be coffee. It's thick enough to stand a spoon up in, and it has way more caffeine than the kiddie pops like Red Bull. Take it from someone who's read the Wikipedia entry. This is how the Ottoman Empire was won. Maddened horsemen fueled by lethal jet-black coffee mud. I pulled out my debit card to pay, and he made a face.
No more debit, he said.
Huh? Why not? I'd paid for my coffee habit on my card for years at the Turks. He used to hassle me all the time, telling me I was too young to drink this stuff, and he still refused to serve me at all during school hours, convinced that I was skipping class. But over the years, the Turk and me have developed a kind of gruff understanding. He shook his head sadly.
You wouldn't understand. Go to school, kid.
There's no surer way to make me want to understand than to tell me I won't. I wheedled him, demanding that he tell me. He looked like he was going to throw me out, but when I asked him if he thought I wasn't good enough to shop there, he opened up.
The security, he said,
looking around his little shop with its tubs of dried beans and seeds, its shelves of Turkish groceries.
The government. They monitor it all now. It was in the papers. Patriot Act 2. The Congress passed it yesterday. Now they can monitor every time you use your card. I say no. I say my shop will not help them spy on my customers.
My jaw dropped.
You think it's no big deal, maybe? What is the problem with governments knowing when you buy coffee? Because it's one way they know where you are, where you've been. Why you think I left Turkey? Where you have government always spying on the people is no good. I moved here 20 years ago for freedom. I know help them take freedom away.
You're going to lose so many sales, I blurted. I wanted to tell him he was a hero and shake his hand, but that was what came out. Everyone uses debit cards.
Maybe not so much anymore. Maybe my customers come here because they know I love freedom, too. I am making sign for window. Maybe other stores do the same. I hear the ACLU will sue them for this.
You've got all my business from now on, I said. I meant it. I reached into my pocket. I don't have any cash, though. He pursed his lips and nodded.
Many people say the same thing. It's okay. You give today's money to the ACLU.
In 2 minutes, the Turk and I had exchanged more words than we had in all the time I'd been coming to his shop. I had no idea he had all these passions. I just thought of him as my friendly neighborhood caffeine dealer. Now I shook his hand, and when I left his store, I felt like he and I had joined a team. A secret team. I'd missed 2 days of school, but it seemed like I hadn't missed much class. They'd shut the school on one of those days while the city scrambled to recover. The next day had been devoted, it seemed, to mourning those missing and presumed dead. The newspapers published biographies of the lost, personal memorials. The web was filled with these capsule obituaries, thousands of them. Embarrassingly, I was one of those people. I stepped into the schoolyard, not knowing this, and then there was a shout, and a moment later there were 100 people around me, pounding me on the back, shaking my hand. A couple girls I didn't even know kissed me, and they were more than friendly kisses. I felt like a rock star. My teachers were only a little more subdued. Ms. Galvez cried as much as my mother had, and hugged me 3 times before she let me go to my desk and sit down. There was something new at the front of the classroom. A camera. Ms. Galvez caught me staring at it and handed me a permission slip on smeary Xeroxed school letterhead. The board of the San Francisco Unified School District had held an emergency session over the weekend and unanimously voted to ask the parents of every kid in the city for permission to put closed-circuit television cameras in every classroom and corridor. The law said they couldn't force us to go to school with cameras all over the place, But it didn't say anything about us volunteering to give up our constitutional rights. The letter said that the board was sure that they would get complete compliance from the city's parents, but that they would make arrangements to teach those kids whose parents objected in a separate set of unprotected classrooms. Why did we have cameras in our classrooms now? Terrorists, of course. Because by blowing up a bridge, terrorists had indicated that schools were next. Somehow, that was the conclusion that the board had reached anyway. I read this note 3 times, and then I stuck my hand up.
Yes, Marcus?
Ms. Galvez, about this note?
Yes, Marcus.
Isn't the point of terrorism to make us afraid? That's why it's called terrorism, right?
I suppose so.
The class was staring at me. I wasn't the best student in school, but I did like a good in-class debate. They were waiting to hear what I'd say next. So aren't we doing what the terrorists want from us? Don't they win if we act all afraid and put cameras in the classrooms and all of that? There was some nervous tittering. One of the others put his hand up. It was Charles. Ms. Galvez called on him.
Putting cameras in makes us safe, which makes us less afraid.
Safe from what? I said, without waiting to be called on.
Terrorism,
Charles said. The others were nodding their heads.
How do they do that? If a suicide bomber rushed in here and blew us all up...
Ms. Galvez, Marcus is violating school policy. We're not supposed to make jokes about terrorist attacks.
Who's making jokes?
Thank you, both of you,
Ms. Galvez said. She looked really unhappy. I felt kind of bad for hijacking her class.
I think that this is a really interesting discussion, but I'd like to hold it over for a future class. I think that these issues may be too emotional for us to have a discussion about them today. Now let's get back to the suffragists, shall we?
So we spent the rest of the hour talking about suffragists and the new lobbying strategies they'd devised for getting 4 women into every Congress critter's office to lean on him and let him know what it would mean for his political future if he kept on denying women the vote. It was normally the kind of thing I really liked, little guys making the big and powerful be honest. But today I couldn't concentrate. It must have been Daryl's absence. We both liked social studies, and we would have had our school books out and an IM session up seconds after sitting down, a back channel for talking about the lesson. I'd burned 20 paranoid Xbox discs the night before, and I had them all in my bag. I handed them out to people I knew were really, really into gaming. They'd all gotten an Xbox Universal or two the year before, but most of them had stopped using them. The games were really expensive and not a lot of fun. I took them aside between periods, at lunch and study hall, and sang the praises of the paranoid Xbox games to the sky. Free and fun. Addictive social games with lots of cool people playing them from all over the world. Giving away one thing to sell another is what they call a razor blade business. Companies like Gillette give you free razor blade handles and then stiff you by charging you a small fortune for the blades. Printer cartridges are the worst for that. The most expensive champagne in the world is cheap when compared with inkjet ink, which costs all of a penny a gallon to make wholesale. Razor blade businesses depend on you not being able to get the blades from someone else. After all, if Gillette can make $9 on a $10 replacement blade, why not start a competitor that makes only $4 selling an identical blade? An 80% profit margin is the kind of thing that makes your average business guy go all drooly and round-eyed. So razor blade companies like Microsoft pour a lot of effort into making it hard and/or illegal to compete with them on the blades. In Microsoft's case, every Xbox has had countermeasures to keep you from running software that was released by people who didn't pay the Microsoft blood money for the right to sell Xbox programs. The people I met didn't think much about this stuff. They perked up when I told them that the games were unmonitored. These days, any online game you play is filled with all kinds of unsavory sorts. First, there are the pervs, who try to get you to come out to some remote location so they can go all weird and Silence of the Lambs on you. Then there are the cops, who are pretending to be gullible kids so they can bust the pervs. Worst of all, though, are the monitors who spend all their time spying on our discussions and snitching on us for violating their terms of service, which say no flirting, no cussing, and no clear or masked language which insultingly refers to any aspect of sexual orientation or sexuality. I'm no 24/7 horn dog, but I'm a 17-year-old boy. Sex does come up in conversation every now and again. But God help you if it came up in chat while you were gaming. It was a real buzzkill. No one monitored the paranoid Xbox games because they weren't run by a company. They were just games that hackers had written for the hell of it. So these game kids loved the story. They took the discs greedily and promised to burn copies for all their friends. After all, games are most fun when you're playing them with your buddies. When I got home, I read that a group of parents was suing the school board over the surveillance cameras in the classrooms, but that they'd already lost their bid to get a preliminary injunction against them. I don't know who came up with the name XNet, but it stuck. You'd hear people talking about it on the Muni. Van called me up to ask me if I'd heard of it, and I nearly choked once I figured out what she was talking about. The discs I'd started distributing last week had been sneaker-netted and copied all the way to Oakland in the space of 2 weeks. It made me look over my shoulder like I'd broken a rule and now the DHS would come and take me away forever. They'd been hard weeks. The BART had completely abandoned cash fares now, switching them for ARFID contactless cards that you waved at the turnstiles to go through. They were cool and convenient, but every time I used one, I thought about how I was being tracked. Someone on XNet posted a link to an Electronic Frontier Foundation white paper on the ways that these things could be used to track people, and the paper had tiny stories about little groups of people that had protested at the BART stations. I use the XNet for almost everything now. I'd set up a fake email address through the Pirate Party, a Swedish political party that hated internet surveillance and promised to keep their mail accounts a secret from everyone, even the cops. I accessed it strictly via XNet, hopping from one neighbor's internet connection to the next, staying anonymous, I hoped, all the way to Sweden. I wasn't using Winston anymore. If Benson could figure it out, anyone could. My new handle, come up with on the spur of the moment, was Mikey, that is, M1K3Y, and I got a lot of email from people who heard in chat rooms and message boards that I could help them troubleshoot their XNet configurations and connections. I missed Harajuku Fun Madness. The company had suspended the game indefinitely. They said that for security reasons, they didn't think it would be a good idea to hide things and then send people off to find them. What if someone thought it was a bomb? What if someone put a bomb in the same spot? What if I got hit by lightning while walking with an umbrella? Ban umbrellas! Fight the menace of lightning! I kept on using my laptop, though I got a skin-crawly feeling when I used it. Whoever had wiretapped it would wonder why I didn't use it. I figured I'd just do some random surfing with it every day, a little less each day so that anyone watching would see me slowly changing my habits, not doing a sudden reversal. Mostly I read those creepy obits, all those thousands of my friends and neighbors dead at the bottom of the bay. Truth be told, I was doing less and less homework every day. I had business elsewhere. I burned new stacks of paranoid Xbox every day, 50 or 60, and took them around the city to people I'd heard were willing to burn 60 of their own and hand them out to their friends. I wasn't too worried about getting caught doing this because I had good crypto on my side. Crypto is cryptography, or secret writing, and it's been around since Roman times. Literally, Augustus Caesar was a big fan and liked to invent his own codes, some of which we use today for scrambling joke punchlines and email. Crypto is math. Hard math. I'm not going to try to explain it in detail because I don't have the math to really get my head around it either. Look it up on Wikipedia if you really want. But here's the Cliff's Notes version. Some kinds of mathematical functions are really easy to do in one direction and really hard to do in the other direction. It's easy to multiply two big prime numbers together and make a giant number. It's really, really hard to take any given giant number and figure out which primes multiply together to give you that number. That means that if you can come up with a way of scrambling something based on multiplying large primes, unscrambling it without knowing those primes will be hard. Wicked hard. Like a trillion years of all the computers ever invented working 24/7 won't be able to do it. There are four parts to any crypto message. The original message, called the clear text. The scrambled message, called the ciphertext. The scrambling system, called the cipher. And finally, there's the key. Secret stuff you feed into the cipher along with the clear text to make ciphertext. It used to be that crypto people tried to keep all of this a secret. Every agency and government had its own ciphers and its own keys. The Nazis and the Allies didn't want the other guys to know how they scrambled their messages, let alone the keys that they could use to de-scramble them. That sounds like a good idea, right? Wrong. The first time anyone told me about all this prime factoring stuff, I immediately said, "No way, that's BS. I mean, sure, it's hard to do this prime factorization stuff, whatever you say it is, but it used to be impossible to fly or go to the moon or get a hard drive with more than a few kilobytes of storage. Someone must have invented a way of descrambling the messages." I had visions of a hollow mountain full of National Security Agency mathematicians reading every email in the world and snickering. In fact, that's pretty much what happened during World War II. That's the reason that life isn't more like Castle Wolfenstein, where I've spent many days hunting Nazis. The thing is, ciphers are hard to keep secret. There's a lot of math that goes into one, and if they're widely used, then everyone who uses them has to keep them a secret too. And if someone changes sides, you have to find a new cipher. The Nazi cipher was called Enigma, and they used a little mechanical computer called an Enigma machine to scramble and unscramble the messages they got. Every sub and boat and station needed one of these, so it was inevitable that eventually the Allies would get their hands on one. When they did, they cracked it. That work was led by my personal all-time hero, a guy named Alan Turing, who pretty much invented computers as we know them today. Unfortunately for him, he was gay. So after the war ended, the stupid British government forced him to get shot up with hormones to cure his homosexuality, and he killed himself. Daryl gave me a biography of Turing for my 14th birthday, wrapped in 20 layers of paper and in a recycled Batmobile toy. He was like that with presents, and I've been a Turing junkie ever since. Now the Allies had the Enigma machine, and they could intercept lots of Nazi radio messages, which shouldn't have been that big a deal since every captain had his own secret key. Since the Allies didn't have the keys, having the machine shouldn't have helped. Here's where secrecy hurts crypto. The Enigma cipher was flawed. Once Turing looked hard at it, he figured out that the Nazi cryptographers had made a mathematical mistake. By getting his hands on an Enigma machine, Turing could figure out how to crack any Nazi message, no matter what key it used. That cost the Nazis the war. I mean, don't get me wrong. That's good news. Take it from a Castle Wolfenstein veteran. You wouldn't want the Nazis running the country. After the war, cryptographers spent a lot of time thinking about this. The problem had been that Turing was smarter than the guy who thought up Enigma. Anytime you had a cipher, you were vulnerable to someone smarter than you coming up with a way of breaking it. And the more they thought about it, the more they realized that anyone can come up with a security system that he can't figure out how to break, but no one can figure out what a smarter person might do. You have to publish a cipher to know that it works. You have to tell as many people as possible how it works, so that they can thwack on it with everything they have, testing its security. The longer you go without anyone finding a flaw, the more secure you are. Which is how it stands today. If you want to be safe, you don't use crypto that some genius thought of last week. You use the stuff that people have been using for as long as possible without anyone figuring out how to break them. Whether you're a bank, a terrorist, a government, or a teenager, you use the same ciphers. If you tried to use your own cipher, there'd be the chance that someone out there had found a flaw you missed and was doing a Turing on your butt, deciphering all your secret messages and chuckling at your dumb gossip, financial transactions, and military secrets. So I knew that crypto would keep me safe from eavesdroppers, but I wasn't ready to deal with histograms. I got off the BART and waved my card over the turnstile as I headed up to the 24th Street station. As usual, there were lots of weirdos hanging out in the station, drunks and Jesus freaks and intense Mexican men staring at the ground and a few gang kids. I looked straight past them as I hit the stairs and jogged up to the surface. My bag was empty now, no longer bulging with the paranoid Xbox discs I'd been distributing, and it made my shoulders feel light and put a spring in my step as I came up the street. The preachers were at work still, exhorting in Spanish and English about Jesus and so on. The counterfeit sunglass sellers were gone, but they'd been replaced by guys selling robot dogs that barked the national anthem and would lift their legs if you showed them a picture of Osama bin Laden. There was probably some cool stuff going on in their little brains, and I made a mental note to pick a couple of them up and take them apart later. Face recognition was pretty new in toys, having only recently made the leap from the military to casinos trying to find cheats to law enforcement. I started down 24th Street toward Potrero Hill and home, rolling my shoulders and smelling the burrito smells wafting out of the restaurants and thinking about dinner. I don't know why I happened to glance back over my shoulder, but I did. Maybe it was a little bit of subconscious sixth sense stuff. I knew I was being followed. They were two beefy white guys with little mustaches that made me think of either cops or the gay bikers who rode up and down the Castro. But gay guys usually had better haircuts. They had on windbreakers the color of old cement and blue jeans, with their waistbands concealed. I thought of all the things a cop might wear on his waistband, of the utility belt that DHS guy in the truck had worn. Both guys were wearing Bluetooth headsets. I kept walking, my heart thumping in my chest. I'd been expecting this since I started. I'd been expecting the DHS to figure out what I was doing. I took every precaution, but Severe Haircut Lady had told me that she'd be watching me. She'd told me I was a marked man. I realized that I'd been waiting to get picked up and taken back to jail. Why not? Why should Daryl be in jail and not me? What did I have going for me? I hadn't even had the guts to tell my parents, or his, what had really happened to us. I quickened my step and took a mental inventory. I didn't have anything incriminating in my bag. Not too incriminating, anyway. My school book was running the crack that let me IM and stuff, but half the people in school had that. I'd changed the way I encrypted the stuff on my phone. Now I did have a fake partition that I could turn back into clear text with one password, but all the good stuff was hidden and needed another password to open up. That hidden section looked just like random junk. When you encrypt data, it becomes indistinguishable from random noise, and they'd never even know it was there. There were no disks in my bag. My laptop was free of incriminating evidence. Of course, if they thought to look hard at my Xbox, it was game over, so to speak. I stopped where I was standing. I'd done as good a job as I could of covering myself. It was time to face my fate. I stepped into the nearest burrito joint and ordered one with carnitas, shredded pork, and extra salsa. Might as well go down with a full stomach. I got a bucket of horchata, too, An ice-cold rice drink that's like watery, semi-sweet rice pudding. Better than it sounds. I sat down to eat, and a profound calm fell over me. I was about to go to jail for my crimes, or I wasn't. My freedom since they'd taken me in had been just a temporary holiday. My country was not my friend anymore. We were now on different sides, and I'd known I could never win. The two guys came into the restaurant as I was finishing the burrito and going up to order some churros, deep-fried dough with cinnamon sugar, for dessert. I guess they'd been waiting outside and got tired of my dawdling. They stood behind me at the counter, boxing me in. I took my churro from the pretty granny and paid her, taking a couple of quick bites of the dough before I turned around. I wanted to eat at least a little of my dessert. It might be the last dessert I got for a long, long time. Then I turned around. They were both so close I could see the zit on the cheek of the one on the left, the little booger up the nose of the other. "Excuse me," I said, trying to push past them. The one with the booger moved to block me. "Sir," he said, "can you step over here with us?" He gestured toward the restaurant's door. "Sorry, I'm eating," I said, and moved again. This time he put his hand on my chest. He was breathing fast through his nose, making the booger wiggle. I think I was breathing hard, too, but it was hard to tell over the hammering of my heart. The other one flipped down a flap on the front of his windbreaker to reveal an SFPD insignia. "Police," he said. "Please, come with us." "Let me just get my stuff," I said. "We'll take care of that," he said. The booger one stepped right up close to me, his foot on the inside of mine. You do that in some martial arts, too. It lets you feel if the other guy is shifting his weight, getting ready to move. I wasn't going to run, though. I knew I couldn't outrun fate. Chapter 7. They took me outside and around the corner to a waiting, unmarked police car. It wasn't like anyone in that neighborhood would have had a hard time figuring out that it was a cop car, though. Only police drove big Crown Victorias now that gas had hit $7 a gallon. What's more, only cops could double park in the middle of Van Ness Street without getting towed by the schools of predatory tow operators that circled endlessly, ready to enforce San Francisco's incomprehensible parking regulations and collect a bounty for kidnapping your car. Booger blew his nose. I was sitting in the back seat, and so was he. His partner was sitting in the front, typing with one finger on an ancient ruggedized laptop that looked like Fred Flintstone had been its original owner. Booger looked closely at my ID again. "We just want to ask you a few routine questions." "Can I see your badges?" I said. These guys were clearly cops, but it couldn't hurt to let them know I knew my rights. Booger flashed his badge at me too fast for me to get a good look at it. But Zit, in the front seat, gave me a long look at his. I got their division number and memorized the 4-digit badge number. It was easy. 1337 is also the way hackers write LEET or ELITE. They were both being very polite, and neither of them was trying to intimidate me the way that the DHS had done when I was in their custody. "Am I under arrest?" "You've been momentarily detained so that we can ensure your safety and the general public safety," Booger said. He passed my driver's license to Zit, who pecked it slowly into his computer. I saw him make a typo and almost corrected him, but figured it was better to just keep my mouth shut. "Is there anything you want to tell me, Marcus? Do they call you Mark?"
"Marcus is fine," I said.
Booger looked like he might be a nice guy. Except for the part about kidnapping me into his car, of course.
"Marcus, anything you want to tell me?"
"Like what? Am I under arrest?"
"You're not under arrest right now," Booger said. "Would you like to be?"
"No," I said.
"Good. We've been watching you since you left the BART. Your fast pass says that you've been riding to a lot of strange places at a lot of funny hours."
I felt something let go inside my chest. This wasn't about the X-Net at all, then. not really. They'd been watching my subway use and wanted to know why it had been so freaky lately.
How totally stupid.
So you guys follow everyone who comes out of the BART station with a funny ride history? You must be busy.
Not everyone, Marcus. We get an alert when anyone with an uncommon ride profile comes out, and that helps us assess whether we want to investigate. In your case, we came along because we wanted to know why a smart-looking kid like you had such a funny ride profile.
Now that I knew I wasn't about to go to jail, I was getting pissed. These guys had no business spying on me. Christ, the BART had no business helping them to spy on me. Where the hell did my subway pass get off on finking me out for having a non-standard ride pattern?
I think I'd like to be arrested now, I said. Booker sat back and raised his eyebrow at me.
Really? On what charge?
Oh, you mean riding public transit in a non-standard way isn't a crime?
Zit closed his eyes and scrubbed them with his thumbs. Booger sighed a put-upon sigh.
Look, Marcus, we're on your side here. We use this system to catch bad guys, to catch terrorists and drug dealers. Maybe you're a drug dealer yourself. Pretty good way to get around the city, a fast pass. Anonymous.
What's wrong with anonymous? It was good enough for Thomas Jefferson. And by the way, am I under arrest?
Let's take him home, Zit said. We can talk to his parents.
I think that's a great idea, I said. I'm sure my parents will be anxious to hear how their tax dollars are being spent.
I'd pushed it too far. Booger had been reaching for the door handle, but now he whirled on me, all hulked out and throbbing veins.
Why don't you shut up right now while it's still an option? After everything that's happened in the past 2 weeks, it wouldn't kill you to cooperate with us. You know what? Maybe we should arrest you. You can spend a day or two in jail while your lawyer looks for you. A lot can happen in that time. A lot. How'd you like that?
I didn't say anything. I'd been giddy and angry. Now I was scared witless. I'm sorry, I managed, hating myself again for saying it.
Booger got in the front seat, and Zit put the car in gear, cruising up 24th Street and over Potrero Hill. They had my address from my ID. Mom answered the door after they rang the bell, leaving the chain on. She peeked around it, saw me, and said,
Marcus? Who are these men?
Police, Booker said. He showed her his badge, letting her get a good look at it, not whipping it away the way he had with me.
Can we come in?
Mom closed the door and took the chain off and let them in. They brought me in, and Mom gave the three of us one of her looks.
What's this about?
Booger pointed at me.
We wanted to ask your son some routine questions about his movements, but he declined to answer them. We felt it might be best to bring him here.
Is he under arrest?
Mom's accent was coming on strong. Good old Mom. Are you a United States citizen, ma'am? Zit said.
She gave him a look that could have stripped paint.
I sure am, yuck,
she said in a broad southern accent.
Am I under arrest?
The two cops exchanged a look. Zit took the four. We seem to have gotten off to a bad start. We identified your son as someone with a non-standard public transit usage pattern, as part of a new proactive enforcement program. When we spot people whose travels are unusual or that match a suspicious profile, we investigate further.
Wait, Mom said. How do you know my son uses the Muni?
The Fast Pass, he said. It tracks voyages.
I see,
Mom said, folding her arms. Folding her arms was a bad sign. It was bad enough she hadn't offered them a cup of tea. In Momland, that was practically like making them shout through the mail slot. But once she folded her arms, it was not going to end well for them. At that moment, I wanted to go and buy her a big bunch of flowers. Marcus here declined to tell us why his movements had been what they were.
Are you saying you think my son is a terrorist because of how he rides the bus?
Terrorists aren't the only bad guys we catch this way, Zit said. Drug dealers, Gang kids, even shoplifters smart enough to hit a different neighborhood with every run.
You think my son is a drug dealer?
We're not saying that, Zit began. Mom clapped her hands at him to shut him up.
Marcus, please pass me your backpack.
I did. Mom unzipped it and looked through it, turning her back to us first.
Officers, I can now affirm that there are no narcotics, explosives, or shoplifted goo-gars in my son's bag. I think we're done here. I would like your badge numbers before you go, please.
Booger sneered at her.
Lady, the ACLU was suing 300 cops on the SFPD. You're going to have to get in line.
Mom made me a cup of tea and then chewed me out for eating dinner when I knew that she'd been making falafel. Dad came home while we were still at the table, and Mom and I took turns telling him the story. He shook his head.
Lillian, they were just doing their jobs.
He was still wearing the blue blazer and khakis he wore on the days that he was consulting in Silicon Valley.
The world isn't the same place it was last week.
Mom set down her teacup.
Drew, you're being ridiculous. Your son is not a terrorist. His use of the public transit system is not cause for a police investigation.
Dad took off his blazer.
We do this all the time at my work. It's how computers can be used to find all kinds of errors, anomalies, and outcomes. You ask the computer to create a profile of an average record in a database, and then ask it to find out which records in the database are furthest away from average. It's part of something called Bayesian analysis, and it's been around for centuries now. Without it, we couldn't do spam filtering.
So you're saying that you think the police should suck as hard as my spam filter? I said. Dad never got angry at me for arguing with him, but tonight I could see the strain was running high in him. Still, I couldn't resist. My own father taking the police's side.
I'm saying that it's perfectly reasonable for the police to conduct their investigations by starting with data mining, and then following it up with legwork where a human being actually intervenes to see why the abnormality exists. I don't think that a computer should be telling the police whom to arrest, just helping them sort through the haystack to find a needle.
But by taking in all that data from the transit system, they're creating the haystack, I said. That's a gigantic mountain of data, and there's almost nothing worth looking at there. From the police's point of view, it's a total waste.
I understand that you don't like that this system caused you some inconvenience, Marcus. But you, of all people, should appreciate the gravity of the situation. There was no harm done, was there? They even gave you a ride home.
They threatened to send me to jail, I thought, but I could see there was no point in saying it.
Besides, you still haven't told us where the blazing hells you've been to create such an unusual traffic pattern.
That brought me up short. I thought you relied on my judgment, that you didn't want to spy on me. He'd said this often enough. Do you really want me to account for every trip I've ever taken? I hooked up my Xbox as soon as I got to my room. I'd bolted the projector to the ceiling so that it could shine on the wall over my bed. I'd had to take down my awesome mural of punk rock handbills I'd taken down off telephone poles and glued to big sheets of white paper. I powered up the Xbox and watched as it came onto the screen. I was going to email Van and Holu to tell them about the hassle with the cops, but as I put my fingers to the keyboard, I stopped again. A feeling crept over me, one not unlike the feeling I'd had when I realized that they'd turned poor old Salma Gundy into a traitor. This time, it was the feeling that my beloved XNet might be broadcasting the location of every one of its users to the DHS. It was what Dad had said. You ask the computer to create a profile of an average record in a database, and then ask it to find out which records in the database are furthest away from average. The XNet was secure because its users weren't directly connected to the Internet. They hopped from Xbox to Xbox until they found one that was connected to the Internet. Then they injected their material as undecipherable, encrypted data. No one could tell which of the Internet's packets were XNet and which ones were just plain old banking and e-commerce and other encrypted communication. You couldn't find out who was tying the X-Net, let alone who was using the X-Net. But what about Dad's Bayesian statistics? I'd played with Bayesian math before. Daryl and I once tried to write our own better spam filter, and when you filter spam, you need Bayesian math. Thomas Bayes was an 18th century British mathematician that no one cared about until a couple hundred years after he died, when computer scientists realized that his technique for statistically analyzing mountains of data would be super useful for the modern world's info Himalayas. Here's some of how Bayesian stats work. Say you've got a bunch of spam. You take every word that's in the spam and count how many times it appears. This is called a word frequency histogram, and it tells you what the probability is that any bag of words is likely to be spam. Now, take a ton of email that's not spam, in the biz they call that ham, and do the same. Wait until a new email arrives and count the words that appear in it. Then use the word frequency histogram in the candidate message to calculate the probability that it belongs in the spam pile or the ham pile. If it turns out to be spam, you adjust the spam histogram accordingly. There are lots of ways to refine the technique, looking at words in pairs, throwing away old data, but this is how it works at core. It's one of those great, simple ideas that seems obvious after you hear about it. It's got lots of applications. You can ask a computer to count the lines in a picture and see if it's more like a dog line frequency histogram or a cat line frequency histogram. It can find porn, bank fraud, and flame wars. Useful stuff. And it was bad news for the X-Net. Say you have the whole internet wiretapped, which, of course, the DHS has. You can't tell who's passing X-Net packets by looking at the contents of those packets, thanks to crypto. What you can do is find out who is sending way, way more encrypted traffic out than everyone else. For a normal internet surfer, a session online is probably about 95% clear text, 5% ciphertext. If someone is sending out 95% ciphertext, maybe you could dispatch the computer-savvy equivalents of Booger and Zit to ask them if they're terrorist drug dealer X-Net users. This happens all the time in China. Some smart dissident will get the idea of getting around the Great Firewall of China, which is used to censor the whole country's internet connection by using an encrypted connection to a computer in some other country. Now, the party there can't tell what the dissident is surfing. Maybe it's porn, or bomb-making instructions, or dirty letters from his girlfriend in the Philippines, or political material, or good news about Scientology. They don't have to know. All they have to know is that this guy gets way more encrypted traffic than his neighbors. At that point, they send him to a forced labor camp just to set an example so that everyone can see what happens to smartasses. So far, I was willing to bet that the X-Net was under the DHS's radar, but it wouldn't be the case forever. And after tonight, I wasn't sure that I was in any better shape than a Chinese dissident. I was putting all the people who signed onto the X-Net in jeopardy. The law didn't care if you were actually doing anything bad. They were willing to put you under the microscope just for being statistically abnormal. And I couldn't even stop it. Now that the X-Net was running, it had a life of its own. I was going to have to fix it some other way. I wished I could talk to Holu about this. He worked at an internet service provider called PigSpleenNet that had hired him when he was 12, and he knew way more about the net than I did. If anyone knew how to keep our butts out of jail, it would be him. Luckily, Van and Holu and I were planning to meet for coffee the next night at our favorite place in the mission after school. Officially, it was our weekly Harajuku Fun Madness team meeting, but with the game canceled and Daryl gone, it was pretty much just a weekly weep fest, supplemented by about 6 phone calls and IMs a day that went, "Are you okay? Did it really happen?" It would be good to have something else to talk about.
You're out of your mind,
Vanessa said.
Are you actually totally, really for real crazy or what?
She had shown up in her girls' school uniform because she'd been stuck going the long way home, all the way down to the San Mateo Bridge, then back up into the city, on a shuttle bus service that her school was operating. She hated being seen in public in her gear, which was totally Sailor Moon, a pleated skirt and a tunic and knee socks. She'd been in a bad mood ever since she turned up at the cafe, which was full of older, cooler, mopey emo art students who snickered into their lattes when she turned up. "What do you want me to do, Van?" I said. I was getting exasperated myself. School was unbearable now that the game wasn't on, now that Daryl was missing. All day long in my classes, I consoled myself with the thought of seeing my team, what was left of it. Now we were fighting.
I want you to stop putting yourself at risk, Mikey.
The hairs on the back of my neck stood up. Sure, we always used our team handles at team meetings, but now that my handle was also associated with my XNet use, it scared me to hear it said aloud in a public place.
Don't use that name in public anymore, I snapped.
Van shook her head.
That's just what I'm talking about. You could end up going to jail for this, Marcus, and not just you. Lots of people. After what happened to Daryl...
I'm doing this for Daryl!
Art student swiveled to look at us, and I lowered my voice.
I'm doing this because the alternative is to let them get away with it all. You think you're going to stop them? You're out of your mind. They're the government.
It's still our country, I said.
We still have the right to do this.
Van looked like she was going to cry. She took a couple of deep breaths and stood up.
I can't do it. I'm sorry. I can't watch you do this. It's like watching a car wreck in slow motion. You're going to destroy yourself, and I love you too much to watch it happen.
She bent down and gave me a fierce hug and a hard kiss on the cheek that caught the edge of my mouth.
Take care of yourself, Marcus, she said.
My mouth burned where her lips had pressed it. She gave Holu the same treatment, but square on the cheek. Then she left. Holu and I stared at each other after she'd gone. I put my face in my hands.
Damn it,
I said finally. Holu patted me on the back and ordered me another latte.
It'll be okay, he said. You'd think Van, of all people, would understand.
Van's parents were North Korean refugees.
They'd lived under a crazy dictator for decades before escaping to America, determined to give their daughter a better life.
Holu shrugged.
Maybe that's why she's so freaked out, because she knows how dangerous it can get.
I knew what he was talking about. Two of Van's uncles had gone to jail after her parents got out and had never reappeared.
Yeah, I said. So how come you weren't on XNet last night?
I was grateful for the distraction. I explained it all to him, the Bayesian stuff and my fear that we couldn't go on using XNet the way we had been without getting nabbed. He listened thoughtfully.
I see what you're saying. The problem is that if there's too much crypto in someone's internet connection, they'll stand out as unusual. But if you don't encrypt, you'll make it easy for the bad guys to wiretap you.
Yeah, I said. I've been trying to figure it out all day.
Maybe we could slow the connection down, spread it out over more people's accounts.
Won't work, he said.
To get it slow enough to vanish into the noise, you'd have to basically shut down the network, which isn't an option.
You're right, I said.
But what else can we do? What if we change the definition of normal?
And that was why Holu got hired to work at Pigspleen when he was 12. Give him a problem with two bad solutions, and he'd figure out a third, totally different solution based on throwing away all your assumptions. I nodded vigorously. Go on, tell me.
What if the average San Francisco internet user had a lot more crypto in his average day on the internet? If we could change the split so it's more like 50-50 clear text to ciphertext, then the users that supply the XNet would just look like normal.
But how do we do that? People just don't care enough about their privacy to surf the net through an encrypted link. They don't see why it matters if eavesdroppers know what they're Googling for.
Yeah, but web pages are small amounts of traffic. If we got people to routinely download a few giant encrypted files every day, that would create as much ciphertext as thousands of web pages.
You're talking about IndyNet, I said.
You got it,
he said. IndyNet, all lowercase, always, was the thing that made PigSpleenNet into one of the most successful independent ISPs in the world. Back when the major record labels started suing their fans for downloading their music, a lot of the independent labels and their artists were aghast. How can you make money by suing your customers? PigSpleen's founder had the answer. She opened up a deal for any act that wanted to work with their fans instead of fighting them. Give PigSpleen a license to distribute your music to its customers, and it would give you a share of the subscription fees based on how popular your music was. For an indie artist, the big problem isn't piracy, it's obscurity. No one even cares enough about your tunes to steal them. It worked. Hundreds of independent acts and labels signed up with PigSpleen, and the more music there was, the more fans switched to getting their internet service from PigSpleen, and the more money there was for the artists. Inside of a year, the ISP had 100,000 new customers, and now it had 1 million, more than half the broadband connections in the city. An overhaul of the IndyNet code has been on my plate for months now, Holu said. The original programs were written really fast and dirty, and they could be made a lot more efficient with a little work, but I just haven't had the time. One of the high-marked to-do items has been to encrypt the connections, just because Trudy likes it that way. Trudy Du was the founder of PigSpleen. She was an old-time San Francisco punk legend, the singer-frontwoman of the anarcho-feminist band Speed Whores, and she was crazy about privacy. I could totally believe that she'd want her music service encrypted on general principles. Will it be hard? I mean, how long would it take? Well, there's tons of crypto code for free online, of course, Holu said. He was doing the thing he did when he was digging into a meaty code problem, getting that faraway look, drumming his fingers on the table, making the coffee slosh into the saucers. I wanted to laugh. Everything might be destroyed and crap and scary, but Holu would write that code. Can I help? He looked at me. What? You don't think I can manage it? What? I mean, you did this whole XNet thing without even telling me, without talking to me. I kind of thought that you didn't need my help with this stuff. I was brought up short.
What?
I said again. Holu was looking really steamed now. It was clear that this had been eating at him for a long time.
Holu, he looked at me and I could see that he was furious. How had I missed this? God, I was such an idiot sometimes. Look, dude, it's not a big deal.
By which he clearly meant that it was a really big deal.
It's just that, you know, you never even asked. I hate the DHS. Daryl was my friend, too. I could have really helped with it.
I wanted to stick my head between my knees.
Listen, Holu, that was really stupid of me. I did it at like 2 in the morning. I was just crazy when it was happening. I
couldn't explain it.
Yeah, he was right, and that was the problem. It had been 2 in the morning, but I could have talked to Holu about it the next day, or the next. I hadn't, because I'd known what he'd say, that it was an ugly hack, that I needed to think it through better. Holu was always figuring out how to turn my 2 a.m. ideas into real code, but the stuff that he came out with was always a little different from what I'd come up with. I'd wanted the project for myself. I'd gotten totally into being Mikey.
I'm sorry, I said at last.
I'm really, really sorry. You're totally right. I just got freaked out and did something stupid. I really need your help. I can't make this work without you.
You mean it?
Of course I mean it, I said. You're the best coder I know. You're a goddamn genius, Holu. I would be honored if you'd help me with this.
He drummed his fingers some more. It's just, you know, you're the leader. Van's the smart one. Daryl was... He was your second-in-command, the guy who had it all organized, who watched the details. Being the programmer, that was my thing. It felt like you were saying you didn't need me. Oh, man, I'm such an idiot. Holu, you're the best qualified person I know to do this. I'm really, really, really... All right, stop. Fine. I believe you. We're all really screwed up right now. So yeah, of course you can help. We can probably even pay you. I've got a little budget for contract programmers.
Really?
No one had ever paid me for writing code. Sure. You're probably good enough to be worth it. He grinned and slugged me in the shoulder. Holu's really easygoing most of the time, which is why he'd freaked me out so much. I paid for the coffees and we went out. I called my parents and let them know what I was doing. Holu's mom insisted on making us sandwiches. We locked ourselves in his room with his computer and the code for IndyNet, and we embarked on one of the great all-time marathon programming sessions. Once Holu's family went to bed around 11:30, we were able to kidnap the coffee machine up to his room and go IV with our magic coffee bean supply. If you've never programmed a computer, you should. There's nothing like it in the whole world. When you program a computer, it does exactly what you tell it to do. It's like designing a machine, any machine, like a car, like a faucet, like a gas hinge for a door, using math and instructions. It's awesome in the truest sense. It can fill you with awe. A computer is the most complicated machine you'll ever use. It's made of billions of micro-miniaturized transistors that can be configured to run any program you can imagine. But when you sit down at the keyboard and write a line of code, those transistors do what you tell them to. Most of us will never build a car. Pretty much none of us will ever create an aviation system, design a building, lay out a city. Those are complicated machines, those things, and they're off-limits to the likes of you and me. But a computer is like 10 times more complicated, and it will dance to any tune you play. You can learn to write simple code in an afternoon. Start with a language like Python, which was written to give non-programmers an easier way to make the machine dance to their tune. Even if you only write code for one day, one afternoon, you have to do it. Computers can control you, or they can lighten your work. If you want to be in charge of your machines, you have to learn to write code. We wrote a lot of code that night. Chapter 8. I wasn't the only one who got screwed up by the histograms. There are lots of people who have abnormal traffic patterns, abnormal usage patterns. Abnormal is so common, it's practically normal. The X-Net was full of these stories, and so were the newspapers and the TV news. Husbands were caught cheating on their wives. Wives were caught cheating on their husbands. Kids were caught sneaking out with illicit girlfriends and boyfriends. A kid who hadn't told his parents he had AIDS got caught going to the clinic for his drugs. Those were the people with something to hide. Not guilty people, but people with secrets. There were even more people with nothing to hide at all, but who nevertheless resented being picked up and questioned. Imagine if someone locked you in the back of a police car and demanded that you prove that you're not a terrorist. It wasn't just public transit. Most drivers in the Bay Area have a fast-track pass clipped to their sun visors. This is a little radio-based wallet that pays your tolls for you when you cross the bridges, saving you the hassle of sitting in a line for hours at the toll plazas. They'd tripled the cost of using cash to get across the bridge, though they always fudged this, saying that fast-track was cheaper, not that anonymous cash was more expensive. Whatever holdouts were left afterward disappeared after the number of cash lanes was reduced to just one per bridgehead, so that the cash lines were even longer.
So if you're a local, or if you're driving a rental car from a local agency, you've got a fast track. It turns out that toll plazas aren't the only place that your fast track gets read, though. The DHS had put fast track readers all over town. When you drove past them, they logged the time and your ID number, building an ever more perfect picture of who went where and when, in a database that was augmented by speeding cameras, red light cameras, and all the other license plate cameras that had popped up like mushrooms. No one had given it much thought, and now that people were paying attention, we were all starting to notice little things, like the fact that the fast track doesn't have an off switch. So if you drove a car, you were just as likely to be pulled over by an SFPD cruiser that wanted to know why you were taking so many trips to the Home Depot lately, and what was that midnight drive up to Sonoma last week about. The little demonstrations around town on the weekend were growing. 50,000 people marched down Market Street after a week of this monitoring. I couldn't care less. The people who'd occupied my city didn't care what the natives wanted. They were a conquering army. They knew how we felt about that. One morning I came down to breakfast just in time to hear Dad tell Mom that the two biggest taxi companies were going to give a discount to people who used special cards to pay their fares, supposedly to make drivers safer by reducing the amount of cash they carried. I wondered what would happen to the information about who took which cabs where. I realized how close I'd come. The new IndyNet client had been pushed out as an automatic update just as this stuff started to get bad, and Holu told me that 80% of the traffic he saw at Pigspleen was now encrypted. The XNet just might have been saved. Dad was driving me nuts, though.
"You're being paranoid, Marcus,"
he told me over breakfast one day as I told him about the guys I'd seen the cops shaking down on the BART the day before. "Dad, it's ridiculous. They're not catching any terrorists, are they? It's just making people scared."
"They may not have caught any terrorists yet, but they're sure getting a lot of scumbags off the streets. Look at the drug dealers. It says they've put dozens of them away since this all started. Remember when those druggies robbed you? If we don't bust their dealers, it'll only get worse."
I'd been mugged the year before. They'd been pretty civilized about it. One skinny guy who smelled bad told me he had a gun. The other one asked me for my wallet. They even let me keep my ID, though they got my debit card and fast pass. It had still scared me witless and left me paranoid and checking my shoulder for weeks. "But most of the people they hold up aren't doing anything wrong, Dad," I said. This was getting to me. My own father. "It's crazy. For every guilty person they catch, they have to punish thousands of innocent people. That's just not good."
"Innocent? Guys cheating on their wives? Drug dealers? You're defending them, but what about all the people who died? If you don't have anything to hide,
so you wouldn't mind if they pulled you over?" My dad's histograms had proven to be depressingly normal so far.
"I'd consider it my duty," he said. "I'd be proud. It would make me feel safer."
Easy for him to say.